This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast for January 13th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome. Well, it is a cold morning, Jackie, out there. I don't know. I think it was like minus 26 overnight. I don't know.
And more cold weather coming.
And more cold weather coming. It's going into the minus 30s. But hey, it's winter. That's the way it's supposed to be. But metaphorically, I'd say it's only been 2 weeks into the year, and the news from the oil and gas industry has been relatively cool. I'd say the hottest thing we've heard in the last week was Cenovus going to net zero, their announcement that they're going to try and achieve net zero in the next couple decades.
Yeah, and I see that as really big news. I think we need more big oil and gas producers to sign up for these commitments, and I hope that Cenovus's leadership inspires others. Yeah. We're going to talk more about that.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that. But actually, speaking of Cenovus, they were spun out of Encana in 2009. You know, Encana went more gassy and spun out its oil sands asset and created Cenovus. And so the big announcement, actually, the hot announcement later last year in 2019, I think it was in October, was that Encana was moving its headquarters from Calgary to Denver. And that was really very contentious because, of course, Encana has strands of DNA, corporate DNA, going back all the way to the Canadian Pacific Company, we've got Pan-Canadian, Alberta Energy Corporation, and so on. So it did not go over well to see a storied Canadian company cross the border and take its corporate baggage from one side to the other. So we thought, well, why not invite Doug Suttles, someone who I've known for a long time, CEO of Encana, to our podcast. So that's what we're doing. Welcome, Doug.
Thanks, Peter and Jackie. Glad to be here.
Great. So we're going to have lots to cover today with you, Doug. We're going to talk about Encana's history since you joined in 2013, including shifting the headquarter, your perspectives on the economics of Canada versus US since you invest in both. And we're going to talk a little bit about the hard fall of the oil and gas equities over the past several years and how you are responding and your company responding to the changing expectations from oil and gas investors. But before we do that, we just want to introduce everyone to you. Doug, please give the audience a bit of a summary of yourself and how you came to lead Encana, which is soon to be Ovintiv.
Well, I'm a longtime oil and gas guy. I'm the third generation in my family. Interestingly enough, my family's all from the Permian Basin, from West Texas. My mom grew up in Midland, Texas, and my dad grew up just outside of a town called Big Spring, and my parents were actually married in Midland. And my daughter is generation four in our family in this industry. I'm an engineer by background. My career's taken me all over the world. I've worked from Alaska to the Middle East. I've worked the onshore and the offshore. I've worked in developed countries and parts of the developing world. So it's been a fascinating ride. And of course, in 2013, it led me to Encana, just about the same time the shale revolution was taking off. So to be honest, it's been something I never dreamed of as a child, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, and Encana has changed quite a bit as you saw that opportunity. So for example, in 2013, the company was 85% gas. Today, it's 55% liquids. And at that time when you joined, mostly the production was from Canada. And today, only about a third of the production is from Canada. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts at that time that caused those big shifts in the company's profile in terms of how much liquids production it had and its geographic location?
Well, yeah, Jackie, as you said, we were a very large gas producer both in Canada and the United States in 2013. And we actually had a real problem when I joined, which is the Marcellus Shale. At the time, I think it was producing something like 7 billion cubic feet a day, and it was forecast at that point to go to something like 20 billion cubic feet in 2018. Turns out it went to 27. And we had a problem because our portfolio, our gas portfolio, couldn't compete with that resource. So we had to re-examine who we were, what we were, and even more importantly, where we thought the industry would go. So what we did is, after taking a hard look at things, believed that it was going to be very difficult to compete with the Marcellus Shale and then later on associated gas. But we did believe that unconventional oil shales, were fundamentally going to not only get bigger, they were going to get better. Their cost structures were going to drop down and become essentially the big thing that was going to drive the industry. And of course, that's turned out to be the case. So we pivoted our portfolio. And of course, something else to remember is back in 2013, natural gas was trading just below $4 and oil was trading just under $100. Of course, today gas is struggling to see $2 and oil's around $60. And just to put a sharp edge on this, if we put today's prices on the business we had in 2013, we would have made $800 million of cash flow last year. But if you actually look at our second and third quarters, the last two that are publicly released, and annualize those, we made $3.4 billion. So it was, I think, really important we did this. And along the way, I think probably the last point is we thought about this. We said, if oil unconventionals are going to be where you want to be, how do you build around that and ensure that you can compete very effectively? And we really came up with four things. One is, it's really hard to be a successful oil and gas company if you're in the wrong places. So we call that being in the best rocks. We're a capitally intensive industry and execution matters a lot. And we think you have a lot of control as to how you do that. Capital allocation is key. Your capital has to follow strategy. And then lastly, something I think we're a little unique in the emphasis we put on it is around midstream and markets and how that can be a differentiator. And of course, to do all that, we embarked on a big change in our culture to go with it. So that's kind of why we made the pivot we made. It turned out to be the right one. And today, actually, interestingly enough, there's only one company in the world last year who drilled more unconventional wells than us. And actually, we're the second largest independent oil and gas producer in North America today. So it's been a fascinating journey and one we're really glad we undertook.
Sounds like you made the pivot at the right time based on how the markets evolved. So a lot of insight to recognize that shale oil and shale gas was a transformational change, and a lot of other players took a while to really realize that.
Yeah, I mean, Encana has seen a series of product pivots. I mean, the spinning out of Cenovus was really a pivot away from oil sands and into pure gas and liquids. And then after that, recognizing that natural gas was going to become so abundant that it's almost coming out of the ground for free, moving towards the high value, I'd say, middle liquids, you know, the lighter liquids was a great move. But maybe talk about now the corporate pivot, moving from Canada, Calgary, to the United States, Denver. You want to talk a little bit about the rationale behind that?
Yeah, Peter, it's something as a company we've been studying for a number of years now, largely driven off of this big investment trend in the public markets around passive investing. The majority of the money flowing into the public markets these days is moving in a passive way. So whether it's buying indexes or buying ETFs in certain areas, as opposed to historically, which was picking individual stocks. And we don't believe in the advice we've had from our advisors that this was going to change. And in fact, when you look at our business and you look at our peers, because most people compare us predominantly to U.S. independents, largely because we're not an oil sands producer. And in fact, today about 75% of our shares are owned in the United States. But when you compare us to those peers, the analysis we did and our advisors also did showed that they have 3 to 4 times the passive investment in their enterprises. And this is substantial, and it's particularly substantial when, as we all know, energy has not been in favor the last few years and investors have been hard to come by. So we think it put our shareholders at a disadvantage, and we felt we needed to move to capture that. It really wasn't about Canada or the U.S. It was really about capturing this big trend in passive investing and making sure that our shareholders would also benefit from that.
Yeah, so just to crystallize that thought, the buying and selling of shares of Encana had historically, as any other stock, oil and gas or otherwise, had historically largely been at the discretion of a human being making a call, comparing balance sheets and income statements and profitability and buying. But increasingly, the trend over the past few years has been for robotic trading, algorithmic trading, and also, as you pointed out, these ETFs, exchange-traded funds, where the money basically moves into a basket of stocks, say a collection of oil and gas companies such as Encana, of Encana's size, and that in Canada, that flow was still very weak, and in the United States, it's considerably stronger. And so you made the decision in large part to move to be able to get greater liquidity, in other words, turning over of the Encana stock and trading, which then leads to greater value creation for shareholders. Is that a fair assessment of the one of the dominant reasons?
Yeah, Peter, it is. And as you know, today, if an individual were to invest their savings, you know, whether it's for retirement or a home or a child's education, whatever it is, in many cases, they'll do something like buy the S&P 500 index or the S&P 400 index. These are massive funds and attracting a large amount of capital. But by being a Canadian company, we couldn't be in those indexes. So when they bought that fund, they didn't get any shares of Encana, but they did get shares of our peers. And we thought that put us at a real disadvantage.
Okay. So does this imply, do you think, that Canadian companies have a capital barrier that U.S. firms do not have? I guess so, because the market is so much bigger there and these ETFs are so much bigger that you lose out by not being part of the U.S. market.
Well, Jackie, I think it's almost case by case. I think it's really hard to generalize here. And I think what made it even a bigger issue for us is the fact that the large Canadian oil and gas companies are almost all oil sands enterprises. And we've chosen for strategic reasons not to participate in that play. I'm not sure it's universal, but I do think it is one of these things that every company has to look at as they think about how to make sure their shareholders are getting full value for their investments.
And the reality is, I mean, you had already biased your assets significantly to the United States. So U.S. investors, U.S. ETFs would make the play on U.S. assets.
That's right, Peter. I mean, when you look at our portfolio, because we focus on unconventionals and we focus on liquids rich, and particularly crude and condensate rich unconventionals, that generally means we're competing against mostly U.S. independents. Very, very few Canadian companies participate in that market across North America like we do. So we think that put us at a unique disadvantage compared to essentially what is our peer group.
Okay, so we've got the rationale from a capital markets standpoint. Earlier, you had talked about the need to be in the best rocks as you made that transition from gas to liquids. I guess I'm going to ask you the tough question that, are you implying that Canada does not have the best rocks when it comes to liquids?
You know, I'm not. And in fact, you know, Peter, I know you and I've spoken on this many times. We've been the champion for condensate-rich unconventionals in Canada. And throughout this relatively difficult period over the last 5 or 6 years in the industry, we've consistently invested in and grown our business here in Canada, focused in particular, the Montney, because we think it's a world-class play that competes with any unconventional play anywhere, both in scale and in quality, in particular because the key product there is condensate, which is a premium product in Canada. It's unique in the oil and gas space in that it is a premium product, largely because we need a lot of it to support the oil sands as a diluent, and it's imported today. So we think that there are plays here which compete for capital, and we are investing, and that's the reason we've continued to invest in places like the Montney, and have championed it across the industry for quite a while.
So is it a scale issue? I mean, that's what people would say, is that we just don't have the same scale for growth and economics, you know, get the learning curve effects going by drilling, having a long runway of wells to drill to be able to get your costs down. Is that the issue when we think about, say, the Montney as a resource compared to the Permian and other places where you're active?
Well, I think the Montney does have scale. I mean, you know, it's our largest asset by produced volume. It's been one of our biggest growth assets in recent years. But I think there is maybe one difference in that while in Canada we have the Montney play, in the U.S. not only do you have the Permian, you have the Eagle Ford, the Bakken, as just other examples of very large unconventional liquids-oriented plays. I do think, though, there are light liquid plays left in Canada, which I believe will attract capital and will grow over time. And in particular, one of the things we like about investing in the Montney is that it isn't hung up by these egress challenges we have for heavy oil in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't require us to find a solution to that risk. And we think the future has more of those. On the dry gas front, I think it's very difficult, particularly until we get large-scale LNG coming out of Canada, because our product just has to travel too far to its markets today.
Yeah. Well, you've pivoted. Now we've talked about product. We've talked about head office and geography. You've also pivoted your name.
That's right. So Ovintiv is the new name. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how you picked it and the meaning?
Well, Jackie, we're super excited about this, and so is our workforce. It really is about our reflection and commitment to innovation. We just believe so deeply that's what's driven the success of this industry and our own success. We also wanted a distinctive name, because we wanted to create conversations about what we really do, which is provide safe, reliable, and affordable energy for the world. And where this debate and concern around the intersection of climate and energy is so important, we think we need fresh conversations in this space. Our company does go back more than 120 years. It has had several names along that history, but it's always successfully adapted to and thrived through the ever-changing world. So we've been really pleased because the name is so distinctive. It's starting lots of new conversations, which we think are just so critical in today's world and the role energy plays in it.
And so does this imply the change to lower carbon? Is that part of the strategy?
Well, what it really does is it symbolizes the need for having real conversations about how we make sure the world gets the energy it needs while addressing the concerns it has around climate and carbon. And we need real solutions that are really sustainable. And inside the company, one of our big focus areas for a while has been funding efforts around energy education, because if we get these decisions wrong, they will hurt so many people in the world, and particularly the most disadvantaged. So we have to make sure we manage this transition quite well and quite effectively so that people have the energy they need, but we address these other concerns people have with climate.
Now, Encana, as you mentioned, has had many names and has had a long history here in Canada, dating back to lands that were gifted from Sir John A. Macdonald to CP Railway, and actually produced the very first operating gas well in Alberta. So when the news came out about the change of name and headquarters, there was a large vocal reaction to the announcement about moving to the U.S. from politicians, industry leaders, even former leaders of Encana. Most of these commentators blame the move on the Liberal government and the fact that Canadian oil and natural gas is landlocked. You know, first of all, did that reaction surprise you? And do you believe that the political environment contributed somehow to the capital scarcity in Canada compared to the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that we weren't surprised by the public or political reaction, particularly given how heated going into the election the debate around Canadian energy was. So I think that didn't surprise us. But as we stressed all along, this was not a political move. This was not a political statement. And this was not about us moving away from Canada, both as an investor or as an employer. This really was about accessing this passive capital and making sure our shareholders were seeing the full value for the stock. So I think that it wasn't a surprise that it happened, and we did our best to damp down the politics around this because we're proud of our Canadian history and we're proud of our operations here. And as I mentioned a minute ago, we've been one of the most vocal companies about the competitiveness of plays like the Montney. And not only have we talked about it, we've invested in it. In fact, as we sit here today having this conversation, working with Keyera, we're building a very large gas plant in Alberta in our PRA area so that we can continue to invest and grow our condensate production right here in Western Canada.
Yeah, and Canada has, I mean, you've had a lot of your DNA strands in many different countries, going back to Pan-Canadian, Alberta Energy Company in Canada, and then Cenovus, and now you're moving the headquarters, changing your name yet again. So really, it's a North American-based company now, and there's no question that in advance of moving your head office, you, as I said earlier, had moved a large portion of your portfolio already to the United States. But there's also this feeling, I guess, in Canada that it's the end of an era. All these companies are moving to the U.S. There's all this political overlay, pipeline problems, and so on and so forth. And I guess I'm sort of looking at it and saying, Okay, I get it. I certainly, as an investor, understand all the capital markets and those sorts of issues. But I'm look at it and say, Doug, like, is the grass really greener on the other side of the fence moving to the U.S.? We know that things move back and forth. I mean, I've been in the business 30, 35 years. You've been in it, and you've seen sort of the pendulum swing back and forth between companies coming, charging into Canada, and then charging out of Canada. And then, you know, one side gets greener, the other side gets greener. Like, how do you look at that? Because, you know, and I guess this also feeds into the idea that, under a Trumpian world, the politics are better, but under a Democratic world, they're not. Like, how do you think about all that?
Yeah, Peter, it's a really great question. And you know, our industry is more than 140 years old. And across that history, politics and politicians have changed. The public's expectations of companies and energy companies have shifted. So in the end, these things do move around, and we need to be careful about overreacting to those. I think that what does Western Canada have going for it? And the list is very, very similar to the U.S. It has some great resources. It's got some, actually, despite some of the challenges today, it's got some well-developed infrastructure. It has an incredibly well-trained and capable workforce, both on the oil and gas side and the service side. And of course, we've seen politicians and policies move around over time, because those are not elected by us. They're elected by the people. And our view is we have to work with the government that's been elected by the people. And there can be shorter term trends that some of the policies can slow down investment or accelerate it. But those foundational principles about the quality of the resource, the infrastructure, and the people mm-hmm. are still there. And we're big believers that Western Canada is going to continue to play a big role on the energy scene for a very long time to come. And I expect we'll be a part of that as well.
And I think that's what people here really want to hear, is that, yeah, there is the next chapter being played out here. And I would say that there's, you know, a little question in my mind, certainly as we exited the last decade, that there was a policy arbitrage between the United States and Canada in terms of a jurisdiction down in Texas is easier to operate than up here. Now, I don't think a lot of people are going to deny that. But we've talked on this program that actually increasingly it's the financial community, the capital markets, that are imposing policy on oil and gas companies, both in Canada and the United States equally, and that it's these issues of ESG, environment, social governance related issues, that increasingly the financial community, the investors, are actually putting into place fairly draconian policies, basically saying, Doug, you know, we're not going to give you any money. We're not going to be interested in the shares of your company unless you really improve your environmental performance, reduce your carbon emissions. But how do you think about the financial community as being the real arbiter of policy in our business now?
Yeah, Peter, I think these things also move around, because when we think about risks we have to manage and trends that are emerging over time, there's still a great deal of the oil and gas in the world that's produced outside of Canada and the United States. And every one of those places has its own unique risks and concerns around them. So I think that the financial community sometimes gets drawn into what's the hot play at the moment or the focus area. But the true long-term investor, I think, is thinking more deeply and broadly about these factors. I mean, the standards we operate to across the company are similar everywhere. We've been very pleased with the focus Premier Kenney's put on improving regulatory efficiency. That's not lowering standards. It's just about the mechanisms and the processes we all go through to meet those standards and to make sure they're as efficient as possible. So I think these things shift and move around with time, but our business is very capitally intensive. It's tied to the resource. In my career, which has taken me South America, the Middle East, Africa, Russia, the Caspian, the North Sea, I still think Canada and the United States are, on a risk-adjusted basis, are two of the most attractive places in the world to invest into.
One thing that weighs on people's minds here in Canada, I think, is the move and what it might mean to Calgary staffing. I know that you assured people that staffing levels in Calgary and Western Canada wouldn't change. And while that may be the intention, there are still concerns because we've had examples like CNOC purchasing Nexen and Repsol purchasing Talisman, where, you know, after the acquisition, a few years later, staffing levels in Canada were quite a bit lower. Why do you think Ovintiv will be different?
Yeah, well, I think we are different. I think if you think about how we run this company today, where we have corporate functions and even executives in all three of our main offices across the company, and we've been doing this for 6 years, and it's worked very effectively. So not only do we manage our Canadian assets and our Canadian investments right there from our office in Calgary, we have many of our corporate functions and actually more of our corporate executives based in Calgary than anywhere else in the company. And that's working very effectively. We view it as the modern way to work, where we're all very well connected. Information flows, everything from video to email works very effectively. We can move data anywhere in real time. And we have this fantastic workforce with a great track record. And I think what we can do is access these passive capital markets without disrupting people's lives or potentially even disrupting the performance of the corporation. So I think we are different. I think our focus on efficiency and the way we work has driven us here, and it allows us to make this move without impacting jobs, which I'm incredibly pleased.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that'll be a relief to a lot of Western Canadians to hear that.
So we've had a situation in 2019 where there was a broad exodus of investors, getting back to that subject, out of the oil and gas space, both in Canada and the U.S. The indices were down. Canada, I think, finished down about 30%, the United States 20%. Small names were even worse. So how do you see investor interest? And I know we talked about the ETFs and so on in 2020.
Yeah, Peter, I actually think there's starting to be some green shoots emerging here. Clearly, the sector has had a difficult few years, in fact, even a difficult decade. Some of that probably due to its own making, some of it due to what was happening in other sectors in the economy. But I think as particular here in North America, as shale is beginning to mature and is very much in the development mode, and the companies that are driving it are no longer putting all of their money into capturing that opportunity, but are now growing it and at the same time spending less money than they're bringing in, generating free cash. I think that's a business model in an industry which is generally seen as more mature than maybe some, that's more appropriate. And I think it's creating more investor interest. If I use us as an example, you know, 2019 was the second year in a row in which we had strong growth and we generated free cash flow. And we haven't given the detailed guidance for 2020 yet, but we've continued to say we'll do that again this year. And in fact, once again, even if you look at us, not only did we grow, generate free cash, we raised our dividend by 25% in 2019, and we bought back 13% of our stock. This is the new emerging business model for energy, and I think it has more attractiveness to investors, particularly given the valuations that oil and gas is at today.
Last year, 2019, where you had the growth and these increases in dividends, the price of oil for light oils, such as the ones you'd produce, and I think WTI averaged about $56 a barrel. What is the, in your mind, like, what is the lower threshold for viability? Is it $50? Is it $45 on average? What do you think?
Yeah, I think, Peter, that the I think if you watch the industry as a whole, and it's not just restricted to North America, it's somewhere around $50 growth probably completely stops. And companies focus in on their balance sheets, making sure they have good cash flow in their current scale. To get it to shrink, it probably takes considerably lower than that, probably in the lower 40s, because businesses like ours can continue to generate a return on the investments into the 40s. But I think this magic number of somewhere between 50 and 55 is the pivot point. What'll be more interesting is if prices strengthen a bit further, does the additional cash flow move to growth, or does it move to the balance sheet and shareholder returns? I hope it's the latter. I think that's a more sustainable model.
Yeah, I think so too. In fact, on that note, you do a lot of presentations to investors. That's a big part of the CEO's job. As you walk into these meetings and talk to investors, what are they saying? And I'm thinking of the question, Doug, we like your company. We would like you to do X. So what is X?
Yeah, you know, Peter, the hard part is, and this is a conversation I have with my board quite often, because actually different investors and different shareholders have different, very specific actions, even though I think the trend is the same. I think this idea of growth with free cash is strongly held by most investors today. The real debate comes into how do you use the free cash? Mm-hmm. Do you put it towards the balance sheet? Do you put it towards more growth? Do you put it towards buying back stock? That's where there tends to be some variation. So what we've tried to do is get really clear with the market on how we see that. We think the first port of call for cash is to maintain the scale of the business and the dividend. Then after that, we want to maintain a strong balance sheet. Then we'll deliver modest growth. And then excess cash after satisfying all of those demands, we'll look at the conditions at the time. Because if oil prices are high and equities are high, buybacks may not be the best return for the investor. Maybe accumulating it for when the commodity ultimately cycles again. But that's a frame we think is sustainable and mm-hmm. one which we think more and more companies are moving towards.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, the value proposition has definitely changed in terms of what investors want going forward, and that's that capital efficiency. And we've talked about it many times on our show in 2019 as investors are basically saying, show me you can make money and give me some of my money back.
Mm-hmm. When you hit on the big question, which is if the price is if, they yeah. go quite a bit higher. Mm-hmm. Will the priority be for growth or giving money back to shareholders? Doug, many of your peers have made pretty aggressive commitments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, even intermediates in the United States. Is that a question that you get and something you're thinking about?
Well, Jackie, I was just spent the end of last week with a group of big long investors in the sector and some of my peers. And I would tell you that the tone around this conversation has moved fairly significantly over the course of 2019. And I think we all believe that we need to do more in this space, and we actually need to disclose more. And I think one of the challenges we're all talking about is we don't have a common framework to measure and report here. And if I use an analogy that in our industry that worked really well, if I go back about 15 or 20 years ago, we all measured and reported safety differently. And it wasn't until we all decided on some common measures in a common reporting protocol that we started to make pretty significant strides in improving the safety of our industry. I think that we need to do the same thing in this space. So emissions intensity and some other things, which today are defined individually by each company, so they're almost impossible to compare and very difficult for third parties to assess the veracity of. I think we have to move in that direction quite quickly. It's something we're putting support into so that when we report, for instance, our emissions data, you could fairly easily compare and contrast that with our peers. And I promise you that ability will drive further performance gains.
Mm-hmm. And it's something we've talked about quite a bit as well. Mm-hmm. We need to be comparing apples to apples here as a starting point. So that's great to hear that you're working on initiatives. Well, there's so many more things we could ask you, Doug.
But, well, yeah, and I'd love to ask Doug more about collecting art, which I know you're into as well. We share that passion. So, Doug, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on this cold, wintry day. I know you're making your way up to Calgary today, and we hope to continue the conversation with you going forward. But I think that really gives our listeners an insight into some of the decisions that have been made over the past and going forward.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks, Peter and Jackie. We're actually super excited about the changes we're going through now, and we're incredibly proud of our Canadian heritage. Thanks for letting me join you today.
Good. Thank you to our listeners for following us. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.